Blog Talk Radio.
Wonderful, wonderful guests on the line. Are you on the line, Angela?
Yes, I am. Can you hear me?
I can hear you loud and clear. Could you just explain or introduce yourself to the audience?
Yes, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. My name is Angela Walton-Raji. I am a person who researches family history, also known as a genealogist, and I like to really find stories. I like to find the stories in my own family. I like to research the stories from the community or the communities from which my family comes. And I also like to teach others how they can research their family history as well. I do share with others tips on how to do this. I have a YouTube channel, and I also have a weekly podcast called the African Roots Podcast. So if people want to get more ideas on how to research their family history, I am always happy to talk about that.
Now, we had a wonderful conversation yesterday, maybe 2 hours. And
I know.
I learned a great deal. I mean, it was, I don't know where to begin with you. Let's start with who you are and what really prompted you to get involved with genealogy. What was when did you get bit by the bug?
Well, you know, I was a child who was always the one who was asking the questions. You know, if I'm visiting my grandmother or great-grandmother, my question was, whose picture is that on the wall? Who is that? What's this name in the family Bible? Who was that? I was the one who was always asking the questions. And I think in terms of answering your question, I would say the bug probably bit me, or maybe I was just sort of the one just sort of selected to ask the questions, but not just to ask the questions and wait for the answers. I became curious enough to go and find some of the answers myself, but also I found new facts about the family that helped me generate additional questions. And that was well over 20 years ago, and I'm still asking new questions and looking for those answers. So I guess genealogy sort of chose me, but it's given me so much pleasure, and I've seen the effects that it's had in my life in terms of making my life certainly a more meaningful journey, but I've been able to teach others to do the same thing and see them as they come alive and how so many people respond sometimes, even emotionally, when they make that first discovery of an ancestor in the records that they never thought they ever would have been able to find. So,
can you share one of your first discoveries with your family? You know, I played this song, Family Reunion, for a reason, because I feel that these types of discoveries bring the family together. And really,
So
do you remember when you first shared some of your discoveries, you know, with some of your family members, even members that you weren't close to?
Well, yes, I can remember as sharing some things first with my mom. Well, the first time I remember, and there are several firsts, the first time I shared something with my mom on her family that I had started to look up. Then there's also the first time I had made the discovery of Uncle Cephas, who's now at our family reunions. He's kind of the famous Uncle Cephas. Everybody talks about him, and I shared him with an elder in the family who had heard his name. And so that was an experience. And let me just focus on those first two. But, you know, I'm going to change it. I'm going to tell you the first time I actually found a family record at the National Archives. I remember this was, 20 years ago. This is before documents were on the internet. And I remember being at the National Archives in Washington, D.C. I was researching my family, the Walton family. And my great-grandmother's name was Sally Walton. Her husband, my great-grandfather, was Sam Walton. And my grandfather's name was Sam Walton. And I'm cranking the microfilm. And in those days, that's what you had to do. You had to fill the microfilm reader with this film and crank it.
Like a sewing machine, right?
Yeah. I mean, you know, so I'm cranking away, and I'm looking, almost getting dizzy, because these things are going from side to side. They're not going from, the images are not moving from top to bottom or bottom to up. So I'm cranking, and they're going from side to side. I'm getting dizzy as these things are rolling by. I crank it, another image, I roll by. And then finally, I crank, I look. People I don't know, crank, look, people I don't know. And I cranked and cranked. I was on my second reel of microfilm, and I see this thing. I see Walton. I'm like, Sam Walton, Sally Walton, Sam Jr., Houston Walton. And, of course, I literally just gasped. I didn't know what in the world. My heart started pounding. I looked around. Of course, everybody else is doing their thing. They're not looking at me. And I'm just like, oh, my God. Oh, my God, what do I do? I went up to the desk, asked someone to come and tell me what I have found. Of course, they don't know my family. I know my family. But I asked the attendant, and the person came and looked at the record. Oh, that's cool. Who's that? And I'm just, my heart is just pounding. I'm so excited. And emotionally, I was just, I mean, I was stunned to see it. My next thing was, is there any way I could make a copy? Oh, sure. I'll show you how to take it out and make a copy. I was amazed. Couldn't wait to get home to start calling the relatives. You won't believe what I found. At that point, that moment was like crack. I mean, I was totally addicted. Couldn't wait to get back to the archives for more information. What else could I find? And to actually be able to methodically look up something, learn how the records were organized, it was just wonderful. My second experience was finding information on my mom's family when I had asked her what was the name of her grandfather. And she said, you know, he had died before I was born. I really don't know what Grandpa's first name was. He was just always called Grandpa. And so one day I went to the archives. I found her grandmother. I went back 10 years earlier, and there was her grandmother with her grandfather. And he had an unusual first name. His name was Council Martin. This was the Martin family. So I called my mom up. Ma, did you ever hear of your grandfather's name being referred to as Council Martin? As soon as I said it, she said, it sure was. I said, why didn't you tell me? She said, I have not heard that name in over 60 years. I did not remember, but just hearing it. And I realized I had to learn how to ask my questions differently, because sometimes you've got to help an elder. You have to jar their memory. So that was a lesson to me. But I was so excited, and she was so excited to find that as well. And my third first that I'll share with you was when I first found Uncle Cephas. Uncle Cephas was significant because we only heard one thing about him. And the only thing we heard, this was a family from Tennessee. And the only thing we ever heard about Uncle Cephas is that supposedly he shot a white man and ran away to Texas. Well, I decided to see if I could find him. Never could find him in Texas or Tennessee, so I don't know anything about that story. And on a hunch one day, I asked myself, gee, that was a lot going on in the Civil War. I wonder if he was one of the black soldiers in the Union Army in the Civil War. So I pulled up this list of soldiers with the last name that he had. The family name was Bass. And I went through the records, and I'm spelling it all kinds of ways, C-E-P-H-A-S-I-S-U-S, nothing showing up. But I just kind of scrolled through the records looking at this list of soldiers, and I came across this record, S as in Sam, E-P-H-A-S, Cephas. See? Oh, my goodness. Could this be Uncle Cephas? Well, I pulled the record and ordered a file. And at the National Archives, when you order a pension file on a Civil War soldier, you have to wait at least an hour because you fill out a form and they go upstairs and pull it for you. And so it takes about an hour for them to retrieve it. I remember sort of saying a prayer when they brought the file down, let this please be my Uncle Cephas. But, of course, all I know about the man is supposedly he shot a man and ran away to Texas. That's not going to be in a military file. So what else did I know about him? Well, I know that my great-grandfather and his family were born in Giles County, Tennessee. That's all else I knew, except that there was this brother called Cephas. So for him to be my Cephas, he had to meet two criteria. One, he had to be born in Tennessee, and maybe he might have ended up in Texas, according to the family rumor. I opened up the file, and I got to a lot of documents. It was a thick file. And I got to the page where he was filing for his Civil War Union Army pension. And what did he say when he declared his pension to talk about himself? My name is Cephas Bass. I enlisted in the 111th U.S. Colored Infantry. I was born in Giles County, Tennessee. And where was this man living? In LaGrange, Fayette County, Texas. I had found Uncle Cephas. Well, let me tell you, the family was so excited. I called up my cousin, an elder who lived at that time in Oklahoma City, and said, you won't believe it, but I found Uncle Cephas in the records, and he was a Civil War soldier, and he enlisted with another brother. And it just went on and on and on. And, of course, that summer I ended up speaking at the family reunion telling everybody about Uncle Cephas. And now if you say Uncle Cephas at a family reunion, nobody even remembers the story about him supposedly shooting somebody running away to Texas. This is the story of a freedom seeker who not only was seeking freedom, he obtained it, he fought for his freedom, and he won. and he was just, he was an amazing man. So that's to sort of shorten a long story, because I could go on and on.
They are wonderful stories. They are wonderful stories. And we talked a lot about, you know, the image of our ancestors being runaway slaves and mm-hmm. the negative images. And how was this received? You know, so you said now he's no longer known in the family as someone who shot someone and ran away. But he's
right.
known as a hero, a war, a veteran, a Civil War hero.
That's
how
right.
did that, you know, how was that received at the family reunion, especially with the younger people in your
amazing.
Family?
Amazing. First of all, you know, the cousin who she was just ecstatic when I had told her I had found this record, and I sent her copies I had made. And she said, well, that's it. You're speaking at the reunion. And I was a little hesitant. You know, my response was, I don't know if everybody wants to hear about a Civil War soldier. She said, no, you're going to, people need to hear this. Well, I must say I was more than pleasantly surprised. Number one, the room went dead quiet when I started to tell the story. First of all, I had to let all these cousins know, okay, now you, some of you might not know me because you're the next generation. And some of the older folks who were there, they knew my dad. These are my father's first cousins. And, of course, my father was now deceased. So they kind of, you know, they never really got a chance to know me that well. So I had to remind them, you know, my dad's mom is your Aunt Ellen, your own father's, you know, sister. Oh, Aunt Ellen, yeah, remember her. Well, after I introduced myself to them, and most people are kind of settling down, fidgeting, doing things, and then I started to talk about Uncle Cephas. Well, after I got into the story of locating the record, but then I started to tell the story. Number one, our great-grandfather, Mitchell, who was Uncle Cephas's brother, and everybody at this reunion came from Mitchell Bass, and I started talking about this brother who enlisted in the Civil War, who told a story of how he enlisted with his brother, another missing brother that, you know, through slavery they had been separated because our great-grandfather had been sent to Arkansas. This is the family back in Tennessee that I'm finding. And they're hearing about another brother called Braxton. That's a name that had been unknown. People were fascinated. Then he goes on to tell, I'm from Giles County, Tennessee. I enlisted with my brother Braxton, and I also enlisted with my two sons, Henry and Emmanuel. And the room became quiet. It was absolutely amazing. But this is the biggest surprise. Not only were people beginning to listen. Now, you know, children are children. Children are distracted. They want to do things. They want to, you know, have another piece of candy or whatever. And at one point, one of the little boys was reaching for something, I guess, in front of one of his little buddies sitting next to him. And his brother or buddy or whomever it was, cousin, was like, shh, be quiet. I want to listen to this lady. I was amazed. It was, what, 11, 12-year-old child whose posture, you see, I mean, you know, kids fidget. They, you know, they slump. They're children. This child was sitting so erect, this little male child. And he began to listen to the story. And the more I began, because I shared a story, and I wasn't just talking, just me running my mouth, yep. I had a slide, what do you call it, an overhead projector at that time, and I was putting these documents on the screen so they could see that I wasn't telling the story. I'm quoting Uncle Cephas, and I'm quoting the record. And
well, don't you think he was in the room with you?
Pardon me?
Was Uncle Cephas in the room with you?
No, Uncle Cephas. Now, he's a Civil War soldier.
No, I mean by spirit.
Oh, you know he was. Because let me tell you, those little boys, their posture, it was as if somebody had put a 2x4 and nailed it to their spine. They were so straight. They were so proud. They were so empowered. First of all, I'm talking about a Civil War hero, a man who had freed himself, who was captured by Nathan Bedford Forrest. And if your listeners don't know who that is, that's the founder of the Klan. He was a slave trader. He was a general in the Confederate Army. and the 111th U.S. Colored Infantry, you can look it up on Google, they were captured by Nathan Bedford Forrest. And he talks in this record, and I blew it up so they could see it, he talked about how he and his brother, he said he and my kinsmen, meaning, you know, my brother and my sons, we escaped. And you see the documents supporting it from their record. And these young boys were so proud of this uncle that they just couldn't believe it. One of my cousins, a young woman who was present, who was expecting her first child, her father, my cousin, my dad's first cousin, Sylvester, leaned over and said, "If that's a boy, you naming that boy Cephas." It was really, but
awesome.
He had a girl. Oh, no, this next male born in this family is going to be named Cephas. Well, let me tell you something was interesting. The young woman, in fact, who was expecting a child, she did have a girl. And that reunion was 1996. So this is, you know, it's been a long time. Well, last summer I went out to Nevada. That reunion was in Phoenix that year. Well, I was in Nevada last summer, 2010. And the young woman who had the child, well, the child's now a young teenager. And there were other teenagers, you know, children who are young adults who, you know, were more mature, who were at that reunion. Some did not remember the story. Some had never heard the story. The mother of the teenager who was born, the woman who had the child, she said, "Didn't you speak at our reunion in Phoenix?" I said, "Yes, I did." She said, "Didn't you tell us about Uncle Cephas?" I said, "Yes." "Could you please tell that story? These kids in here who are here today have never heard that story. Please tell that story again." I would have said, my heart was so warmed by that. Because let's put it this way, Uncle Cephas came back, okay? It was just heartwarming, and I just can't say enough about it. But anyway, you can see I talk a lot. I'm sorry.
Yeah, well, you're doing an exceptional job. I know some schools, they make it mandatory, a part of their curriculum, to trace your roots.
Mm-hmm.
What do you say about, you know, schools embracing that idea?
I think it's not a bad idea, but my hope is that they don't haphazardly assign it. I've heard situations where children are just sort of given a haphazard assignment where they are sort of told to, well, go and talk to your family and put together a family tree, but they're not really given guidance. There does need to be, number one, a curriculum on how to conduct the research, on what to look for. And these days, it can be done far more easily than it used to be done. And even though I still hear about sometimes those haphazard assignments that are given, but there are methods that are there, and my hope is that they will involve, if at all possible, a genealogical organization or a body. It doesn't have to be a formal organization, but a group of individuals who are familiar with the research methods, because there are methods to document it, and you want to teach young people to start to make a connection between themselves, their family, and history. You know, history is sometimes taught with a bunch of just meaningless names and dates. But when you start to share how your family connects this period of time, it totally changes the perception, and it just increases the self-esteem of the students so much. And
I have to share this story because you bring it to mind. I have a friend who went on a genealogy trip. She didn't know it was a genealogy trip. It was just a family sort of family reunion. And
uh-huh.
At this event, they talked about a great-great-grandfather and how he was the first one in the town to own a brick home and a store. And
wow.
She came back so proud. And she said, for Black History Month, and her daughter goes to a primarily white school,
uh-huh.
instead of writing about Martin Luther King or Malcolm X, your paper is going to be on our great-great-grandfather and what he uh-huh. accomplished. So when we find out these, you know, we have these revelations to the family because of people like you who are modern-day griots, I think it really affects the family in a positive way, and it also sheds light on the negative things that we go through as far as the runaway slave. So with that said, could you talk to us more about the Native American heritage and, you know, how you got involved with that? And I know you have a website related to how to research.
Sure. Well, there are, again, of course, many people hear stories about having Native American ancestry. Some could very well be true. Some could be perhaps just family lore. Any type of family research, regardless of the ethnic group, involves the same strategy. And by strategy, that means, first of all, conducting oral history. Ask a series of questions to the elders. Then after asking questions of the elders, hunt for vital records, birth, marriage, and death records. And then at that point, proceed to federal records like the census records. Look at the local records, the courthouse records. Regardless of one's ethnic background, if a person has lived and breathed in the last 150 years, there's a record. There is more than one. There are many records that are going to reflect the history. And the records are going to reflect the history of what your family was. Now, there are many people who are going to say, oh, you could tell my grandmother or grandfather was Native American because they had cheekbones of a certain kind or had a certain type of hair texture or hair length. That's not genealogy, and that doesn't get you to document. You want to document your history. Now, if you just want to tell a story, you can say anything, but you want to provide the records that help you reach conclusions. There are a series of oral history questions that you can ask. On my website, AfricanNativeAmerican.com, I have sample oral history questions because hopefully an individual can get past just hearing about grandma's hair length, because grandma could have gotten her hair length from someone white as well. That's not genealogy. But I got interested in it because I came from a community that is a historic town on the western frontier. And my great-grandmother was from right across the river in nearby Oklahoma. The part of Oklahoma she was from was the Choctaw Nation. In our family, there were documents when she died. There were records, and there were family documents with her name. There were land records that reflected her name and property once given to her with the Choctaw Nation stamped upon it. I became interested in learning more about that part of East, what is now eastern Oklahoma, and began to look at some documents and was able to document that, yes, my great-grandmother Sally, my great-grandfather Samuel, and their two sons, Houston and Samuel, were also citizens of the Choctaw Nation. I had to learn the context in which those records came. Those records were produced right before Oklahoma statehood in 1907, and their particular file was created in 1899. They were being given land because, yes, they were citizens. They were citizens because Sally and her mother and her family, as well as my great-grandfather Sam, they had all been slaves in Indian Territory. There were five nations that took slaves with them. The slaves that were removed on the Trail of Tears took slaves with them.
Okay, now you're bringing up a lot of history. And can
yes.
we slow down just a little bit and first begin with, you mentioned that you come from a historic town, and then could you explain what the Trail of Tears is? And third, Oklahoma.
Or 1800s, early 1800s, as settlers begin to come in, or invaders, or intruders, as they're also known as, who began to come into America, they wanted more land. Well, the land was not just vacant. The land was occupied, and the land was occupied by people who had been there thousands of years. However, the arrivals from Europe decided, we want this land. And through many series of we'll call them discussions, some people will call it coercion, but through a number of things that took place, a treaty was there were actually several treaties in Georgia and North Carolina. It was the Treaty of New Echota that was signed between the United States government and the Cherokee Nation that they would relocate to the West and lands were going to be reserved for them in Indian Territory. In the Choctaw Nation down in Mississippi, it was the Treaty of Dancing Rabbit that was signed in 1829, where the Choctaws agreed that they would relocate to lands in Indian Territory. The same way with the Chickasaw Nation, the Treaty of Doakesville was signed. So all of these things were happening, and it was decided the Native people would be removed to the West. Now, Florida was different. Florida was a different situation. Florida, you had a group of people that themselves were resisting, and they ran into Florida. They had broken away from the Creek Nation, and they ran into other African people, and they had formed an alliance. And for over 10 or 12 years, you had a series of conflicts known as the Seminole Wars. And the Seminole Wars were basically being fought not because the Indians who were in Florida at the time and some who had fled into Florida said that they weren't going to relocate. With Florida, I'm talking primarily about the Seminoles, because they were an exception. They said, well, we're not leaving with the rest of our compatriots. Those were other Africans who had also fled the Carolinas and Georgia into Florida. So you had the Cherokees, Choctaws, Chickasaws, and Creeks who voluntarily moved and relocated, taking enslaved Africans with them. You had in Florida a group of people said, well, we're taking our friends, these African people, with them. So four of the five tribes took slaves. One group did take compatriots, did take comrades with them. What did happen after arrival, we're now talking the 1840s, you had situations where there were some people, as soon as they got there, they still tried to resist. Keep in mind, here are enslaved Cherokees took 1,200 Africans with them. The other groups took fewer numbers. We're talking, though, a period of 20 to 25 years. By the beginning of 1860, we're talking about 10,000 or so people who were enslaved in Indian Territory.
Angela, who was the president who ordered this Trail of Tears?
Well, it wasn't an order, per se. It was a treaty. It was not a forced treaty. There were individuals who didn't want to leave, however, who were, again, saying, well, wait a minute, this is our land. Just because you cheat so-and-so, you find a treaty, doesn't mean I'm agreeing with it. But it was Andrew Johnson and, Andrew Jackson. And he was the person who occupied the White House at the time. And, of course, he wanted to get people out so folks could have more land and could have the land that they thought that the European settlers would prefer. There were many people, even though people were, and many people were dragged out, it was terrible, were forced to leave. There were some people who resisted and who remained and who are still in the communities where they live. In some cases, the groups of people who chose to remain, some went and hid, some chose not to. They were forced then to give up their identity as Native people and to be, sort of blended in, whatever that means,
assimilated,
becoming more acculturated. Although a lot of the people being moved to the West had acculturated to a great degree. Many had become Christian. Many, of course, had embraced slaves. Not all did. Most didn't. But, you know, slavery still took place, and that's how my particular line, that particular line, ended up in the territory. But growing up, you know, certainly in a community
that had that Western frontier history. You know, everybody, you know, on the Western frontier, you hear about it. It's a town, Fort Smith, Arkansas, is a town like Dodge City, Kansas. Everybody knows about it. They celebrate the history all the time. You've got the cowboys, the marshals, and, you know, you have sort of the whole rodeo culture and that sort of thing. But I was surprised to find that there was an abundance, and there is an abundance of records. However, I began to besides educating myself on that part of the history, I became interested in educating myself on other parts. What happened in other places where there was no enslavement of Africans? Well, as I studied the history in New England, I found a situation where people, especially free people of color, free blacks, had a very open relationship with native people. The Mashantucket Pequots are certainly evidence to that. The Shinnecock were triracial people. Some were even, in some communities, biracial, and the biracial mix was native and black.
Said, all right, you and, said triracial, and I want to ask you about the triracial in the Maroons. But before you answer that question, you said Oklahoma received a statehood in 1907?
That is correct.
Now, is it true that they tried to name Oklahoma after a Cherokee? They tried to name the state Sequoia? Are you familiar with that story?
Maybe only very briefly, because keep in mind that the Cherokee Nation was always, once a rival had taken place, was Cherokee Nation, which was specific. But the lands in what is now, if you look at a map of the state of Oklahoma, there were several nations that were designated there. And each tribe had its own nation. The Choctaws, for example, were the very first people to get there. They got there 4 years before the Cherokees arrived. And there was no way in the world that the Choctaw Nation was going to allow its territory to be called Cherokee or Sequoia or anything that had nothing to do with them. Sequoia was of course, a person who did have a lot of influence. He developed the Cherokee syllabary, the Cherokee alphabet, and was a man of influence and prominence as well. But there were a lot of factions. There was, and I think that this is something in particular which many people are not aware of. When the Cherokees arrived after a painful relocation experience. That's why it's called the Trail of Tears, because a third of their people died. And it was not all on foot, even though, the movies may say so. Sometimes they were on foot. But there were quite a few in wagons as well. Some, at some point, they had obviously had to cross the Mississippi and a river on a boat. But they lost at least a third of their population, which is why there was so much weeping on the trail. But you had two factions. You had one faction that was aligned with the Ridge and people who had signed, John Ridge, who was one of the treaty signers. And then you had a totally different faction who was furious. They relocated, but they were furious about relocation. And some others who came later, even though, and I'm not even sure which faction Sequoia was in, but the factions themselves they were leaders in the tribe, but they were so dominant there. And so you had the Ridge faction and you had the John Ross faction. And
right. I think he was part of John Ross. I remember reading his name a lot, John Ross.
John Ross, too. And you got to a situation where one guy ended up burning the other guy's house down. He had a huge mansion. Of course, he was a big slave owner. But you had the factions that did and didn't want to remain and were just furious and livid that one portion of their leaders had gone and signed the treaty.
I know Sequoia was not viewed very well because he was, you mentioned earlier, triracial, and I wanted to find out about the Maroons, and also the Holston Treaty. I don't know if I'm pronouncing it right, Holston or the Long Island Treaty.
Say that last word again.
Holston Treaty.
Okay.
The Long Island.
Okay, my research hasn't taken me into that.
Let's talk about this triracial, and we know that Sequoia, who was also named George Gibbs, he was maybe triracial or biracial. And what is the difference between a triracial person and a maroon?
Well, maroon is actually a word that is taken from the word marron. Marron taken from the word cimarron. Cimarron comes from a Spanish word that was often used to describe one who had strayed away or who had run away. So you had these marrones, or those runaways, who were called marrones or maroons, depending upon, I guess, the language in which one was speaking. And you had many maroon communities, and the maroons actually had started almost as soon as, of course, if you're captured and taken away from that which is familiar to you, you're going to always spend a good portion of your life, whether you're successful or not, trying to regain what was lost. And many of the maroons, they were freedom seekers. And sometimes before, but I guess particularly in those communities, before the plantation system had really gotten a system that worked, meaning worked in keeping people retained, you had situations where entire communities would sometimes leave or run away and could get away. Maybe there were not enough overseers. Who knows what those circumstances are? But you had communities of people who became known, even within an entire community concept, as maroons. They were maroon communities. And the maroons themselves became very strong. Many of them, they were healthy enough to travel, and of course they were healthy enough to fight. They learned a lot about developing their own system of weaponry. Obviously, if you're coming over enslaved, you don't necessarily have weapons of your own, but they also joined forces with some of the people that they had found in Florida, who didn't really just sort of take them in because they were, "Hi, stranger, come join us." They themselves were runaways. So when you had a situation where some of the native people in Florida found runaways also from from the Carolinas, they realized there was strength in numbers. But you asked me something about the triracial. Can you restate the question? I've kind of
right.
lost.
You answered the question about the maroons and the difference between the maroons and the triracial. You mentioned triracial.
Triracial communities were primarily those communities that were, through whatever circumstance politically, they were white, they were black, and they were native. Those were the three racial groups that compiled those communities. I have not seen evidence that Sequoia was triracial. If he was biracial, my guess, considering the time in which he lived,
mm-hmm.
was he may have been biracial, meaning Cherokee and white. I do not have any evidence that he was of African ancestry. Being a leader in the tribe, at that time,
right.
I would doubt that he had African ancestry. But there were others who did in other communities. Looking at Long Island, and looking at some of the other communities in the country, and of course, I have come to study the records, that are fascinating as well.
Right.
So, there's so many stories yet to uncover.
Okay. Now, we're down to our last few minutes. Do you believe that?
Wow. I don't.
Were scheduled for a half hour. We're up to 45 minutes. Can you give our audience all of your information? Again,
sure.
your podcast channel, everything.
Sure. Okay. I'd like to. I do have a few websites. I have a website on researching African and Native American genealogy, and it is simply African with a dash in between the two words, African-Native American, and Native American is all one word with no space, so African-NativeAmerican.com. That's my main website. When you get to that website, you can click on the Twitter button and follow me on Twitter. Or you can click on the blog, which is African-NativeAmerican.blogspot.com, or just click on the button from the website, and that takes you to my blog. I do host a weekly podcast, and that is AfricanRootsPodcast.com. And when you get to that website, you just click on the button and you can listen to the podcast. And all of the podcasts are archived and you can listen to previous broadcasts as well. And I have a blog that also focuses on the United States Colored Troops, researching African soldiers who served in the Union Army in the Civil War. And that is USCT, which stands for United States Colored Troops. It's called USCT Chronicle, C-H-R-O-N-I-C-L-E, chronicle.blogspot.com. And you can also tune into my YouTube channel. Simply, it's a simple one, youtube.com/AY Walton, just my initials, A.Y. Walton. And that's about it, I think.
Well, that's a lot. I didn't
know
you
were going
to take about 3 minutes. You're really using the Internet to network, and you're doing a great job.
Thank you.
I can't let you get away without asking you about the connection to the Underground Railroad and genealogy, and if there's anything you want to say about the Underground Railroad and
There's so much wonderful information that's there. At the same time, and one of the things that I would encourage people to do is to ask some questions about the family, not just who begot who. You want to get more than just a list of names. Trust me, the moment you start giving out a list of names to anybody, their eyes are going to glass over and get bored. You want to find the story. So if you have a family that you know began in Tennessee or Mississippi or Georgia, and the family early on ended up in Ohio or ended up in Michigan, then, you know, you want to ask questions or look at the possibilities that might exist. Did they come during the years of the Great Migration? That's 20th century. Or did they come in the 19th century, meaning the 1800s? Were these individuals who migrated to these regions because they had gone on the Underground Railroad? And the important thing is to learn as much as you can about the network, because it was a network. Now, of course, keep in mind, because it was an underground network, you're not going to be able to cough up a record like you do a census record, which is public information. But what you do want to do is to start to look and see, well, what was the activity of the Underground Railroad in that area, especially if you're living or your family lives in a community that would have been considered the North, or if they perhaps at some point came back into the U.S. in the 1870s, maybe you see a tie to Texas or Mexico. That's a suggestion that they were in a southern community that bled south into Mexico as well. And you want to start to ask other types of questions to see if you can unearth some of the networks and the routes that they may have traveled. The routes and the safe houses, many of which are known, have been documented. And, of course, the people who made the journeys, they're all gone now, so we can't quite ask them directly. But at the same time, you do want to pay attention with your local history. One of the things that you cannot do or you don't want to do is just collect names. Put your family in connection with its local history. If there was a lot of activity, if there were conductors along the railroad, and understand, there were African men and women who also served on the railroad. This is not just a gesture where nice white people were helping these poor unfortunate slaves. There's a black side of that story, too, that deserves to be told. And take a look and learn the history of the movement in the geographic region where your ancestors lived. A wonderful experience will await you.
Quickly, I know that the Bible, the family Bible, is very important, and also family cemeteries.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about
Well, first of all, with the family Bible, you know, when a lot of people will ask me, oh, could you tell me in a few minutes what's the best way to get started? The best way to get started with your family history? Oh, find out who has the Bible. If you don't have it, if your mom doesn't have it, if your grandmother or your Aunt Esther, find out who has the family Bible. You'd be surprised. But there's another resource that I refer to. I refer to the family archive. And a lot of people look at me cross-eyed at like, lady, you're kidding. We do not have an archive. And I say, oh, yes, you do. Do you have a person in your family who goes to everybody's funeral in town?
Yes.
They didn't even have to like them, but they're going to the funeral and going to come back and say, oh, she looks so natural. Let me tell you, that's the person you want to start with. Because
the
that person,
right?
That person.
Someone always collects the funeral programs. Which
there you go. And if you ask them, they might bring out that shoebox or that paper bag or that dresser drawer full of funeral programs. There's history right there. There is history right there. So if there's someone who died in 1960 and you happen to have that funeral program, you may have the document that's going to point you to the community, to the city, the county, and even the parents of the deceased. And you have something that you can use as a launching pad. The family Bibles can be very, very useful. I'll say one thing about a family Bible. You want to evaluate the Bible. And what I mean by that, take a look at the year the Bible was printed. If the year the Bible was printed, let's say the Bible was printed in 1882, and you're always going to find that in the front, then you see all the dates that are written in the family Bible were written after 1882. Then you know you are dealing with probably an original Bible of the family. However,
right.
You have a Bible that was printed by whoever, American Bible Society, whoever, and it was printed in 1945. But the dates in the Bible, in this Bible that was printed in 1945, is giving you dates from 1860. That was copied information. That's not the original Bible. So there's nothing wrong with it, but you want to find the original Bible and always use that printing date of that Bible and then seeing if those dates came afterwards. Then you're probably dealing with the earliest family-produced document. But if the date is in the 40s or the 50s and the dates that were written down on the family history pages are, you know, 50, 60, 70 years earlier, then that information was copied. And you may say, well, what's the difference? It can be a difference. Number one, you want to deal with the original penmanship. You want to get as close to the original as possible because the closer you get to the original, then the closer you are to the artifact itself. And so you want to start to look at your documents, your family items as artifacts because they are. They are truly artifacts. So
wonderful. Last question. We talked about this on the phone on our last conversation. Give us some tips on how to preserve our current history. We said that during this election with President Obama, we were all part of history. We were making history, especially if we voted, we witnessed it. We all were part of this historic
That's
moment.
Right.
How do we become archivists and griots like yourself? You are a griot, and you can explain what that is. You know, how do we ensure that our story is told correctly by us?
Okay, one of the things that I'll simply say, and once you get started documenting your family history, I have often found that, and I've said it, I've had friends who've said it, oh, I sure wish my great-grandmother had left me a pile of letters to go through or a diary or a scrapbook or a journal where I could have half these questions answered. Well, you can do that. Number one, yes. We were a part of history in 2008, and we went to the inauguration. Many of us stood out in the cold. Well, and some sort of collected things anyway. How many people
when Obama was elected, made copies of all those headlines, and some people printed off the headlines from news. I know a lot of people saved the local newspaper where the headline appeared. But there are other websites that printed off those pictures of newspapers from around the world. Now, first of all, if you were there, you have a right to pick up a pen. You know, one of the most popular books, if you go to a Barnes & Noble or Borders Bookstore or whatever, or Books A Million, one of the most popular books on sale are the books that have no words, those blank books. You know why? Those are journals. Those are journals that people who understand the value of journaling, they're going to take it and they're going to write their emotions down. They're going to start to write, you know, and it's still time, you know. Obama's still president. We can still call him president, you know, even though they're trying to knock him down. But, you know, he's still president. We're still experiencing history right now. Start to journal that. Start to go online. You can print off those headlines, those front pages of those newspapers from around the world. Start your own family collection. Start your own scrapbook. But put your version of the story. In other words, I can tell you my version. My version of the story was I was sitting in the den with my husband. I had my little pad of paper, and as the votes were coming in, the electoral votes were coming in, I was writing it down on a paper, and my husband had the bottle of champagne. He says, "We got this, we got this." And then, of course, when we saw his picture on the screen, he was elected. My phone started ringing. I got calls from London, got calls from Nigeria. We were getting calls. My brother called me from Arkansas. My sister-in-law praying on the other end. That's my version of the story. Now, I'm sure you have your version of what happened that night when you were watching the returns come in.
I was videotaping the TV.
Write that down, because you know what? You may have been using a VHS tape. Have you changed it to CD already? And talk about the things that maybe didn't get taped. You had the tape on, but you said something, I know, to that TV screen. Because I remember standing up and just saying, "I don't believe it, I don't believe it, I don't believe it." Write it down. Go and write. Think about what you said. Think about what actually happened and your emotions. You know why? 100 years from now, someone's going to say, "Well, it happened. What were they doing?" You know what? Your great-grandchildren will love you forever. And you know what they say? As long as you can call an ancestor's name, that ancestor never dies. Your ancestors will be talking about you until the 28th century, saying, "Thank God she wrote that down."
Wow. And I was very emotional when I voted. And I thought that was...
Oh, yes, so was I. I had my cameras with me then. Oh, yes. Well, I was in Washington also at the inauguration, and you know what struck me as so amazing? After the inauguration, it was all over. People had souvenirs all over the place. I had to we took the commuter train, had to take the metro and the commuter train back to Baltimore. But what was so amazing is that 2 million people were there, not one arrest. And I was, of course, in the crowds, and what amazed me was sort of a reverent silence. I mean, people were talking, but there was we were moving quietly, throngs of people, so we were moving slowly. Nobody was pushing. Nobody was argumentative. Not one arrest that entire day. Amazing.
I was there, and I remember we had a song. They had us sing a song, a rhythm, as we walked to board the train. So, I mean, it was so organized, and it was over to PA, and as we would take, they would say, "Okay, stop," and then they'll sing the song. When he starts singing the song, that means we had to start moving again.
Oh, okay.
You
were there, too. We were probably there in the same crowd. That's your version of the story, and that's the story that needs to be told. You know, one of the missing stories many of us have in our family histories, those of us who have ancestors who were enslaved, well, how did freedom come? Did they run away? Did they seize their own freedom? Was there a raid of Union soldiers? What happened? What were the details? We don't know that story. And, well, I do on one of my lines because they were documented and they were asked about it. But a lot of the lines, I don't know what happened. So the fact is that 100 years from now, 50 years from now, the family might not know, what did you do? Did you go to the inauguration? What was it like that day? those are the stories that are precious. Yes, keep a journal. Even if you don't, okay, you don't write or can't hold the pen or pencil well, then get a digital recorder and talk into it. Save that as an MP3 file and make it accessible and play it from time to time. As the technology changes, you change with it. Upgrade that file to something else so it can still be retrieved. And I'll tell you another thing, and then I'll stop. You know, when you go to a lot of stores are very popular, like craft stores. You know, one of the biggest sections of a craft store is the scrapbooking section. And you go to the scrapbooking section, you can make your own memories. There are all kinds of ways to do it in a creative way, not just to document the lives of a child with as many pictures as you can take. It's beyond that. Document the events, the critical events, when you go to those. And that was a major event to attend. So if you don't have a scrapbook, create one and put some journaling in it with your reaction to what happened.
Well, I will. I did not do that. But I did save the Metro card with his face on it, and I have everything framed. The newspaper from D.C., the ticket. Someone gave me a ticket. I didn't have a ticket. Someone gave me an inauguration ceremony ticket, and it was like golden to me. And that's all framed in one big picture frame.
And, you know, that's a family artifact. That's one of those things that, you know, folks fight over, you know, after the funeral. You know, I want that, you know. So, but you know what you do? You also make a digital image. So other people who may not be, maybe they're just cousins. Maybe they're not close cousins, but they're cousins. Well, they can still have a picture of great Aunt Leslie's ticket when she went to the inauguration.
Oh, I gave it out to maybe 100 different people. I'm a high school teacher. I gave it to all my students.
Oh, how wonderful.
Copies of everything I went and everything that I brought back, I made digital copies, and I just gave it to everyone. You want to ask, they had a copy as if they were there.
Oh, that's wonderful. One of my my sister-in-law is a high school teacher, and she teaches AP history. And she lives in Arkansas. She knew I was at 101 Constitution, a big, tall building overlooking the Capitol. And so I'm overlooking, you know, the purple section, you know, where all the people had a problem with their seats. But I could see everything. And she asked me the night before, if I call you during my class, would you be able to talk to my class? I'll put you on speaker and can tell people what you see. So I spoke to two of her classes. And at one point, the one class I saw, you know, this is before the ceremony had started. And then the second class I spoke to when the parade was just beginning. And, you know, you saw, well, because I was up on the eighth floor balcony of this building and looking down at the street. And so, you know, you see the policemen forming the V with their motorcycles, and it's a very slow motorcade. And now here comes the president's motorcade.
Ooh.
Right in front of the building where I am, and we're just sitting there like, oh, my God. And, of course, these kids in this history class hearing me saying, oh, my God. And, then of course, he waves a little bit. We see his hand. And because they were just like, oh, my goodness, where are you? And I was talking to the kids. I know these kids had, you know, little computers and things. I said, okay, I want you to go to Google. I want you to Google 101 Constitution Avenue, Washington, D.C. You're going to see the building where I was or where I am, you know, because I was talking to them in the present sense. And they were like, wow, how did you get there? And it's like, that's okay. That's a secret. My husband has friends who work at a law firm. It just happens to be here. But
back by the monument, way back, as far back as you can go.
Oh, okay.
But at least I was there. I was just happy to be there.
You were in the crowd. It didn't matter. You were there. You were there.
Yeah.
You were there. And that's the story you have to tell. And and it's one of those things.
And we're documenting it now through this radio show. We are sharing it in this format. So I think this is a clever way for us to tell our story.
Tell something else.
Keep it.
Your listeners. Who were
they were
watching the television. They have their story to tell. Tell it, you know what I'm saying? Even if they were just at home watching it, they still have. I know people who stayed home from work to watch it. Did tell the story of what you said and what you did. Some people had gatherings at their home. Come over, we got a big screen. We're going to watch the inauguration. So that's a story. Document it. That becomes part of your family story.
Well, I did warn the guests and the audience that this would happen, and I enjoyed talking to you, and we spoke 2 hours earlier before this conversation. So we went on much longer than we expected, but you have to come on more regularly, and I will be tuning into your show. I hope our listeners will also tune into your show and give our listeners one more time your information, and we're going to call it a night.
Okay, thank you. You can reach me at AfricanRootsPodcast.com. That's my podcast site. And if you want to email me, just shoot me an email at AfricanRootsPodcast@gmail.com. That's the best way to reach me.
Wonderful. Angela, I enjoyed this conversation, and we have to do it again. And
thank
you.
It has been a pleasure.
All righty. And have a happy new year.
You do the same. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.